Create Art Podcast. Using creativity with audio drama podcasting. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us here for another episode of Create Art Podcast. Tonight, we're going to be talking creativity, and obviously, it's in the name of the podcast, right? So we're going to be discussing creativity with somebody here that I know you're going to enjoy. He's the creator of the Crimson Files, which is a podcast that I just got hooked on not that long ago, and it's very, if you're into comic books, if you're into action, if you're into comedy, you really need to check out the Crimson Files. He has got a huge resume of podcasts that he has worked on, and he's even done, you know, a little NPR work many years ago. And so I'm proud and pleased to bring on the air tonight, Scott Murray. Scott, how are you this fine evening?
I'm good, Tim. Thank you so much for having me here.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I want to thank you because it's been a little difficult for us to get our schedules together because I know I've been sick. I've got the kids. I've been doing all this kind of crazy stuff. I know you were having some health stuff, and of course, you're running the Crimson Files, which is a fantastic podcast. I'm going to play fanboy here. I'm sorry. I said to myself, I wasn't going to do that, but I think it's important to know that, you know, hey, you got a big fan out here, right here. We're going to be talking creativity tonight. Definitely like to jump into it right off the bat and ask you kind of, you know, what's your biggest challenge that you've overcome in podcasting?
Oh, goodness. Just one?
I tell you what, I'll give you your best three. And, you know, I hit hard from the get-go.
No, it's okay. I was thinking of Ocean's 11. You know what your problem is? I only have one. I think over time I've really managed to improve the ability to grow audience, I think, has definitely improved since those early days. Of course, nowadays, I mean, I started back in 2011, and they didn't track downloads as well as they do today, even though it is still kind of a science they're working through. But back then, I remember I'd have spikes and I'd go, hey, where's this coming from? And they'd say, I don't know. It's either you've had a killer day, either someone's hitting play 55 times on your podcast, or it's a bot, but we don't know. So I think that's definitely been one. And obviously, that's an important one. But I've also learned along the way that a big part of that outside of just the strategy is just making sure you're constantly putting out good content for your existing audience, and not getting too distracted on trying to get people who aren't there yet. Because if you're putting out good content for the people who are already listening, then the others will come.
They definitely will. They definitely will. And I'm going to fanboy on here again. When I first heard the Crimson Files, I'm sitting there thinking, this is a well put together, good sounding show. And yeah, I have my podcaster ears on, and I'm kind of, I don't want to say I'm a snob about it. I can forgive a lot of things, but, you know, just the sound design, the little touches that you do with it, you know, the footfalls, the people getting hit in the face. And I, you know, I don't know how you do it, but, you know, I don't want to be the guy that gets hit in the face for, you know, for the show. Hopefully you have somebody that you're paying a lot of money to do that for.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you
know, just insurance little, though.
Yeah, there you go. But just the little touches that you do there, is really fantastic, you know, and it's something that, you know, a podcaster like me, I'm going to listen for and go, all right, that sounds great. You know, maybe you're, you know, the audience that isn't podcasters, but is into the comic books and into that scene. They're going to appreciate that too, because it reminds me of reading a comic book, you know, where you hear the like the old Batman comic books where you see plow and the thwack and all that good stuff.
Yeah. It's really important to put that effort in there. I mean, because I think most people, especially as podcasts continue to gain popularity and new people finding them all the time, and at the same time with, you know, Apple reporting numbers like there being 700,000 podcasts out there and growing, it means two things. It means one, more people are finding it, which means they too will kind of be able to decide what they like, what they don't like. And that just means with that much out there, you're going to have to work even harder to put something out there that's worth their time. And with fiction podcasting, you know, I just really want to work as hard as I can to do something that A, if you're the kind of person who listens and tries to visualize what's happening, then I'm giving you all the help I can give you without that being too difficult. Because when you're trying to discern what's happening while listening, then suddenly you may not even be paying attention to what somebody's saying or doing because you're too busy trying too hard to figure out what's going on. That even happens with books. You end up having to read something two or three times because you're trying to make sure you understand, okay, this happened and this person's where and who got hit. So sometimes, even in, during the course of production, there are certain things that if you go and get a sound effect, there's just not going to be a sound effect for certain things like sliding out of a chair or you have the sound of, you know, something that's made out of plastic that you have to hear crack or move. Sometimes I'll have to go into a sound effect, pull something that sounds similar and then change the pitch or drag it out or mix it with something to create the sound that I need because that specific thing isn't in the, you know, in the library. So I just think it's really important to give people as much as you possibly can so they have a really good immersive experience in it. And, you know, you're going to have things that are obvious, you know, like if there's a fight, you have to hear punches. You know, if there's a door, if someone's walking in a room, you got to hear the door open. But then there's just all kinds of little details that you can put in there too. Sometimes it could be someone turning around fast. You just got to hear that. And again, there's no sound effect that says person turning around fast. So you have to find a whoosh and then add maybe a little bit of scrape on the gravel or something to show that that's the person turning around. And it just adds a little something. It's interesting how some of those little details are really what makes some of those scenes in a fiction podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really puts you into the story, which, you know, I think you definitely want your audience to be immersed in the story. I know for me, when I listen to it, I'm usually on the train or I'm at work. Mm-hmm. Doing other things, but you know, I've got my attention divided, but there's enough into it that I can go, okay, I can spend 40% of my brain on the work, 40% of my brain on the podcast, and 20% of my brain just kind of looking out the window going, when is lunch? And for me, with the little extra details that you add in there, keeps me at that 40% where I'm like, okay, I'm following the story. I'm liking it. And I'm listening for my favorite character, which we'll talk about a little bit later on in this conversation. But yeah, it really does it for me. It's kind of like, you know, painting a picture and, having, you know, it just, all those little details that a lot of people don't see, you know, the different textures and all that kind of good jazz, that it really comes out in your show. And I just want to let you know, I definitely appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate hearing that. I mean, you know, as podcasters, as you know, sometimes we don't always get to hear feedback, but when we do, it just means everything just because it's reinforcement that people do, you know, value what the time you're putting into things. I've heard a lot of great speeches at podcast conferences over the years where they really drive that point home that, you know, even if you only have, I don't know, you know, 200 downloads per show, those 200 people, you never know the impact you're making on someone's life or what it means to give them an escape. And I think that it's always really good to get that feedback. And I think I had some really good, I'd say, practice with this, because I used to make audio stories when I was a kid using tape recorders and keyboards. Back there's probably some people listening that don't know what I'm talking about, but if you grew up in the 80s and you knew what the SK1 keyboard was, I used that along with several keyboards for music and sound effects and things that I'd bring in boxes for when people fell or fight scenes or whatever. And then before this, I did a podcast called Assembly of Geeks, which was a talk show about geek culture, but we presented it like a story. It was like the hosts and the listeners and the guests were all converging on this Hall of Justice type place to talk about what's happening in the geek world. And there was always a story of some action thing happening in the fortress before the meetings took place. It was like a city council meeting always about geek culture. And you were talking about the little details. I remember we had an arch nemesis on that show called the Troll. And I called him that because it was consistent with, you know, what we call people that will troll you on social media. So this was a guy that would troll us. But he was very Joker-esque. And there was a scene one time where we were in this control center and the troll came in and threw this little explosive. So what you had to hear was you had to hear the laugh, then the throw, and then you had to hear it hit the console because it was going to blow up the console. So originally, when I put it together, the whoosh, and then the clink and the explosion wasn't enough. I thought, okay, that's not helping me visualize, because then you're thinking, well, what metal thing did that just hit? Or what did he throw? So I added just the sound of like one of those quick timers, which made a world of difference. Then you knew it was an explosive. So then it was a, and then you hear this ding, 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 and then a, and then it blew up. Wow. And that little ding, ding, ding made a world of difference just in that scene, because you just understood what was happening a lot better. And I think that goes back to what I was saying regarding, you know, the obvious things, the throw, the explosion, but that dinging sound of the timer just made a world of difference. And I think that was good training for what had to happen in Crimson.
Well, absolutely. I know I have a couple of my listeners here that are contemplating starting up their own audio dramas. As a matter of fact, I got a good buddy of mine that is doing the national daily thing, 30 podcasts in 30 days. Is basically what I call it. And he's doing this little 5-minute thing every day. It's called Pause for Dramatic Effect. He stole that title from me because I throw a lot of theater terms out. And it's a nice little bite-sized thing. He's trying to do it. And, you know, he keeps on asking me, Tim, how do I do these audio dramas? Because I have a theater background. I'm like, go listen to the Crimson Body. Go listen to the Crimson Files and have Scott teach you how to do that. But he's just starting out the process, and it can be very daunting. But just having those little details in that gives you a lot of pride in your own work. Mm-hmm. And it's something that you can put out there because, you know, Scott, you're all over the place. You've got podcasts here and there and everywhere. You've got other things that you're doing during the daytime. Like me, I've got a full-time job in the daytime. It knocks out 10 hours of my day that I can't do anything with podcasting. And for you, I'm sure it's a similar kind of story there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're wanting to put the best thing that we can out, because otherwise, why do it, right?
Yeah. Well, I think no matter what you're doing in the podcast space, I think it's important to put your stamp on it. It's one of the best things you can do from a creative standpoint. I think Assembly of Geeks was proof of that, because really at its core, Assembly of Geeks was a geek talk show. Well, there's about a million of those. Mm-hmm. So I had a choice, and I want to tell people to think about this when they're creating their own shows. I had a choice. I could go find the best sounding one I think I could find and go, okay, we need to be like them. Or I could come up with a way to go, okay, well, if the geek audience has a lot of options out there, what am I going to give them that I can put, you know, a unique stamp on to do something different to where I stand out amongst what everybody else is doing, or most everybody else? I haven't listened to everybody. And that is, come on, talk, and then it's over. So that's when the idea of, well, what if we presented it as a story came up. So I think you're a lot better off if you can come up with just It doesn't have to be complex like that. It might be the way you present the show. It could be the sound elements. It could be ending the show with a specific, you know, a fun question for your guests or for everybody, playing a game or something that's kind of fun that mixes it up a bit. I think it's just really, really important to not shoot for sounding like somebody else, but doing your own thing. And then a big part of what I focus on, and I just keep it as simple as this, is respecting your listeners' time. And that's planning every aspect of the show where you're not killing yourself in editing. But when you get into editing, you know, don't be afraid to take something out that you think disrupts the flow of conversation, even if it's you who says it. I've taken crap out. I've said all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's one of the things I probably get the most feedback from regarding the talk shows and things, is how things move. And that is so valuable to people, especially you're talking about listening to things on the train. The average commute time one time or one way in the United States, I think last I heard, was like 30 minutes.
Yep.
So, you know, I think that's not to say that you should make a podcast 30 minutes and that's the cover, but I'm just saying, in terms of, if you're going to go longer than that, we'll just make sure that you are you're valuing the time of the listener's going to have to take to go 30, 60, or however long you go.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I'm going to ask you to make a little bit longer episodes in the next season, because my commute is about ready to go from 45 minutes to an hour and a half on the train. So, put more episodes per season or something like that. If you're going to keep me in a half hour, more episodes per season. That's just me. That's just,
myself. Well, if I can get a staff, then I'm all over that.
I'll work on that for you. Staying in the creative thing and challenges that you experience. Like I said, I have a theater background, so I'm used to working with other creative types like you are, with your show here. Now, when I write like a play or a poem or something like that, and I have somebody else read it back to me and perform it on stage, that's my little baby that I give to them. But something that I've learned is to kind of let them go with it. And for you, how much leeway, how much freedom do you give your voice actors on The Crimson Files or any other project that you've worked on? How much freedom are you comfortable with giving them?
A lot, actually. I really, and this was true before I did this, before I did audio production, I did a lot of video production. Mm-hmm. And that's how I ended up creating some connections here in the Dallas area where I can go get actors and find actors. Because some of the people that were even involved in season one and season two were actors I worked with on my video stuff. I did an 80s cop show parody here in this area for 4 years. And I developed a really good reputation with the actors, and that was part of it. But I went into that. I never saw myself as, you know, the genius behind it, and everybody else is, you know, working at, you know, my pleasure or something. You know, I looked at us all as one team, trying to make the best production we possibly could. And by the way, that's not just the actors. I mean, I had several scenes that involved extras, people who would show up and sit at dinner tables and things like that in restaurants. I valued those people too, and their time and what they were doing. So I think back then, you know, there was that leeway. And there's been that leeway with Crimson. Because I know that even though I'm happy with what I've put together, is it possible that I walk into a recording session and an actor has a better way of saying something that I have written, or a better idea of what to do with this particular thing? Absolutely. And that doesn't offend me at all. I actually like the fact that they're comfortable with saying, hey, what if we did this? And, you know, if for whatever reason we say, let's keep it this way, I don't think anybody gets offended. But really what ends up happening, and this happened in season two a couple of times, someone will go, what if I read the line like this? That might make it kind of funnier or a little bit funnier. We would just do both. And then in post-production, we can just pick which one, you know. But I wanted them to be able to have that leeway. And it's always there. I'm never jarred by it, and I never discourage it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you kind of build a trust with your actors, with your cast, you know, with the production team as well, that they feel confident and comfortable bringing those ideas. And quite frankly, you know, when I'm doing work with other people, I'm not the smartest guy in the room. Yeah. I like directing it, but I'm just like, hey, listen, this is my idea, but if you've got something better, let's do that. Because bringing it back to, you know, the audience, the listener, the person that is going to, you know, say, hey, this is a great show, and I got to tell 10 of my friends about this show, which everybody needs to do. Everybody listening to the podcast needs to do some files. Okay. I'm going to promote your show like crazy. I do all already.
But, yeah, I'm sorry. I was just going to say it kind of, I mean, I think everybody experiences that because I think that's in line with when you have a full-time job and you know sometimes whether you're working for a leader or a boss.
Yeah.
You know, the boss is the one that, you know, nobody can have a better idea than me because I'm the boss. And then you have the leader who is smart enough to know that there's things they don't know how to do, or someone might have a better idea than them, and they empower their people around them to put their talents at work because that makes everybody better. And I had the pleasure a few months ago of interviewing Harold Ramis's daughter, Violet, for a podcast that I'm late getting out because it's seasonal, but it's an interview podcast. And she had written a book about Harold. And I'd always heard about his approach as a director when we all know him as an actor, obviously, but he did directing too. And she had some great stories about, you know, some of his learning experiences on those first days working on things like Caddyshack. Mm-hmm. And she too would talk about that was his approach. And I think that's one of the many reasons why people liked working with Harold so much is because that was his view. You know, everybody could have a better idea or a better place to shoot something and he didn't mind saying, well, what do you think? And I think that's, that can be very valuable on just about anything, whether it's a production or just, working at a company.
Oh, absolutely. How I got to be in that mindset when I was in the theater world and I was taking a directing class, my teacher tossed at me because I was directing my first thing and I was very, it's my way and this is my vision. So she tossed me a book by William Ball, A Sense of Direction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was talking in that book about, he would have his actors come on up and, he would allow them to do the wildest stuff, bring in the wildest ideas and let them test it out for themselves. And they would eventually find, yeah, that doesn't quite work, but they would come to that realization. They would develop that kind of a trust. And then after they developed that trust, the show was that much better because they came up with better ideas.
Mm-hmm.
and they trusted his vision. And, as soon as I read that, I was like, okay, I'm doing this all wrong.
A light bulb epiphany.
Exactly. Exactly. Something I wanted to bring up with you here. Now, one of our quotes, for, our creativity conversation is by Rumi. And he says, don't be satisfied with stories, how things have gone with others. Unfold your own myth. And definitely with, you know, the Crimson Files, you're definitely unfolding your own myth with that. How does that strike you? I mean, we got Rumi saying this, you know, centuries and centuries ago. So we kind of know this in our collective consciousness. But how does that kind of strike you?
Well, in some ways, I think it goes back to what we were just talking about, you know, that it's a lot more valuable to take something and make it your own than to go, I'm going to make something like that person made it. I think we're looking at a lot of that today with the explosion of geek culture. You know, we see everything from TV shows and movies that almost follow the comic books exactly the way they were done. And then there are those that take some really big liberties. And that's something that's always discussed, is which one's better. Now, on my end, whether it's a book or whether it's a comic book or whatever, I would think most people wouldn't mind some liberties being taken if they're seeing something on the big screen, because otherwise, you know, everything that's going to happen,
exactly.
You know, and you kind of want some new things. And I remember I don't mean to keep throwing in interviews here, but I do learn things just like you. I learn things from interviews. I had the opportunity to interview Clark Gregg a few years ago, you know, who plays Agent Coulson. And we had a good 40-minute conversation. Yeah, we talked about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Marvel and Agent Coulson. But I know he's a writer and he works behind the scenes too. So we got into some of that. And I asked him about it because this was right around the time Spielberg had said, made his comments about comic book movies. I know we just had Scorsese say something about comic book movies. But remember, Spielberg said these things were going to die like the Western. So I asked Clark, I said, well, what do you think about that? I mean, you're in this. You know, what would you say? And he said that as long as audiences and producers, but especially audiences, are willing to take liberties to put new spins on these characters and stories, that is what's going to keep things going. Those fresh takes, you know, new ways to tell the stories, new ways to explore myth. I know that that's something that Lucasfilm is talking about as well, as, you know, with their new trilogies and everything, these are going to be new myths. Mm-hmm. And I think that was interesting because he even admitted, you know, being a comic book fan himself, he said, you know, I catch myself sometimes going, that's not what's in the comics, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But then you remember, oh, but you know, we need these things to be fresh. We need new takes on them, or we need one myth to inspire you to make your own version of that through new characters, new adventures, new stories. Because all those not only provide value from a storytelling standpoint, but then suddenly you've got a new audience that not only loves your stuff, but they learn about Joseph Campbell. They learn about the hero's journey, you know, and thanks to stuff that you're doing, because it's rooted in some of those powerful mythical stories. There's a lot of value to that. So, you know, the good stuff that's timeless is always there, but you know, the important stuff or the new stuff is just as important because, there's value to that. And it really is, if you think about it, that is the way that these stories are kept alive, are by those putting your own spin on them or telling your own myths, as it says.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when we look back through all of literature, it's, you know, it speaks to the time we reinvent it. We retell it for whatever generation is there. I mean, when you look, you know, let's go all the way back to Shakespeare, just, you know, because I'm a theater geek and that's what I do. You know, Romeo and Juliet in Shakespeare's time was a flop. It was nothing. it was Titus Andronicus, which is my favorite Shakespeare play because everybody dies. You know, it's just, it is just ultimate, just, you know, rip your heart out kind of stuff. Unfortunately, fortunately, we had twin girls, but if we would have had a boy, one of them is going to be named Titus Andronicus for sure.
You wouldn't mess with that kid.
Oh, hell no. Hell no. You know, you could chop his arm off, chop his ear off. He's going to take over your whole country and just, you know, lay waste to
just
it.
A flesh wound.
But exactly. You know, we have these stories, you know, and now, you know, you had the Leonardo DiCaprio doing the Romeo and Juliet many years ago. And it was fantastic. You've got different retellings. Well, you've got can't think of his name off the top of my head. Kenneth Branagh. Redoing it. Now he does it cutesy where he's doing all the asides, which that's fine. You know, you're making the movie fantastic. You're bringing culture to the masses, but he's retelling it his way. You have Kevin Costner did Prince of Thieves, Robin Hood. Never mind. Scratch that. but, you know, you have all these retellings of it for each new generation. And, you know, we see that, you know, like you say, with the geek culture, you know, the comic books, you look back, you know, like to Thor. Well, that's a retelling of, you know, the Greek and the Romans, those myths. We're just bringing them up to, you know, Stan Lee's time and afterwards.
Yeah. And it's not uncommon sometimes when people make movie pitches that they'll use other stories to help make their pitch. They'll say, it's like this film, but instead of that, it's this. And sometimes that alone will make them go, okay, got it.
Exactly. Because so it's something they can grasp really easily.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's, you already kind of have half the concept there.
Kind of going on with challenges and all that kind of stuff. I was going to talk more about creativity, but I'm on this challenges kind of thing for some reason. What lessons did you bring from other creative outlets that you've had in the past, like with video production and audio production and all that stuff? What kind of lessons and best practices have you brought from that into podcasting that have helped you out the most?
Well, I think in terms of a massive project, and I say massive because it was massive for me, because I chose to do, Crimson Files. I mean, if you decide to do fiction podcasting, it doesn't have to be nearly as involved as Crimson Files, but that's the route I went. Mm-hmm. And it's a massive project, and you know that going in, and you have these thoughts of, it was like the first episodic thing I had written in many years too. So you're still sitting there thinking, am I still writing things effectively? How is this going to sound when an actor is actually reading it? Mm-hmm. What if I like it on paper and then somebody reads it and I don't? Are we really going to get all this recorded? Am I really going to be able to bring all these people and all these sound effects into the editor and piece it together and get it out on time? And is it going to be worth all the effort, all that stuff? Stuff that typically sometimes can make you go, oh, forget it, it's just not worth all the worry. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things. Because when I was doing the video production, I was going all out. The episodic stuff was an hour long. I had to negotiate all kinds of things, from props to locations to getting extras, places, all myself. My wife and I were the production team. She held the boom mic. I shot the shots and had to go in there with a shot list in my head, and then come home and do music and sound effects, sometimes on two computers, because that's the only way I knew how to do it. So I'd hit two space bars at once while one played, the other one was playing the music and sound effects, and then syncing all those together. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, we go and we show that, because we start having screenings. We ran them on cable for a while, and then people wanted to see them but didn't get cable. So we start having screenings at a local theater. And when you're sitting there and people are laughing and enjoying themselves and they keep coming back, and you're like, gosh, I'm so glad I did this. Mm-hmm. And, you'll hear people talk about that sort of thing a lot, that, even if you produce something and you just think it's okay, or it's not what you thought, you still get a lot of credit just for doing it. There's a lot of people that talk about writing books, and producing movies and writing scripts or writing plays. And they talk about it, but they never actually follow through. Life gets in the way, or they think, oh, that's just going to be so hard. Writer's block comes up. Mm-hmm. But then there's just, a means of showing yourself you can do it, and then you get the rewards from that. And I think, like a lot of things, you kind of prove it to yourself you can do it, then suddenly you're doing a lot more of it.
That's true.
Because you've proven it. So I think that's probably one of the biggest things that translated from one to the other, because I've thought about that. I've wondered, had I not done all this, what would I have, when I asked all those questions and worries about Crimson, would I have actually followed through with it? I don't know, maybe, but it definitely helped that I had something to kind of fall back on, where I thought, I thought these things before and I got it done. So we're going to get this done, and I'm going to give it all I have to see if we can see it through. And it already kind of exceeded expectations. Cause especially that first season felt very experimental. So to think that we actually came back together and did a second one, I mean, that just goes to show you that putting forth the effort paid off. It was really cool to continue the story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And talking about second season and going into, hopefully, third season with, hour and a half long episodes for me.
Epics.
I'm just saying, I'm going to get a little self-indulgent here, and I'm not going to give any spoilers away, because I want everyone to go through the first two seasons. My favorite character, and we were talking about this a little bit in the pre-show notes, is Mr. Bill.
Mm-hmm.
He is my favorite character, and my argument, and I will defend this to the death. So if anyone wants to, if any of your fans want to go ahead and challenge me to a duel, which is what we do out here in Virginia, we'll go ahead and do a duel. My thing is, this whole thing is about Mr. Bill. And can you talk a little bit about, again, I don't want you to give too many mm-hmm. spoilers away or anything like that, but can you talk to me about the whole thing with Mr. Bill? Like, where does he really come from? Because I've had Mr. Bills in my life, and some days I am Mr. Bill, admittedly.
But yeah, there's a little bit of Mr. Bill in all of us, isn't there?
Well, yeah.
Maybe.
I, on Wednesdays and Thursdays, there's a lot of Mr. Bill in me.
Well, as far as it being all about him, he would definitely agree with that. And I think mm-hmm. he's pushing for that through almost halfway through season one and into season two. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things Mr. Bill represents. I mean, this was true even in the 80s cop show parody. You know, you've got the heroes and the villains, just like in Crimson Files. We have the Crimson Crane. She's the hero. She's got her team around her. And then we have Drench as the villain in season one, Regina Ruse in season two. So we've got the things that you expect to have there, but I can't help it. I have to have at least two or three characters in there that have a role. I mean, I think that's the important thing. I don't just stick people in there for a quick laugh, but they don't really seem to fit. They have to have purpose. And I think that's kind of what you're alluding to. Mm-hmm. But I like to have people that do serve a purpose, but at the same time, the audience knows when they show up, they're probably going to do or say something that's going to make you laugh. And those characters come at really good times. There could be a really serious scene that happens, and then it shifts gears to kind of lighten it up. You know, those characters help make those things happen. There's two or three characters in Crimson, I think, that do that pretty well. But yeah, a lot of people talk about Mr. Bill. Mr. Bill is the lead character's boss at his job, because you have the Crimson Crane, who is the hero, but then you got these two guys that basically follow her. Cover her through the internet as an internet news site, and then eventually end up helping her with her missions. And then you have life outside of that action, which is Wyatt sitting at his desk doing work, and he's got this quirky boss. Mm-hmm. What was kind of fun about this is I've heard a lot of people talk about characters they made and then who inspired those characters. I've heard Mike Judge do about that. talk about that when it came to Beavis and Butthead, of all things. J.J. Abrams talked about Maz Kanata being based on a teacher he had in, I think, high school or grade school. And that's what inspired her. I hadn't really done a whole lot of that, at least not in a really deep way. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Bill kind of gave me the opportunity. I wanted to be involved with at least a little bit as a character, but I don't necessarily consider myself a full-blown voice actor as good as the other people in the show. So I thought, well, what could I do where I don't try, you know, to do something that I don't really have the clout to do, but still play a role? Well, yeah. Mr. Bill was my high school algebra and geometry teacher, and he was the quintessential stereotypical teacher in math. I mean, pocket protector, the whole bit.
Yeah,
and had all these things that he would say. His favorite word was quiet. You know, quiet, 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 quiet. I mean, you look at my high school annual, people will remember the fact that I impersonated him throughout high school, not in a mean way, because I actually got his permission to impersonate him on stage at the talent show. So it was never mean.
Right.
But there's a lot of quiet is written in my high school annuals from my friends a lot because nice. of this guy. And I used to make, when I was talking about those cassette tapes, I would make cassette tapes where this teacher was a cop, he was a sheriff, he was a hero, he was all these things. And it was just kind of fun because he was kind of nerdy in high school, but I made him a badass in these tapes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I thought, well, what can I do? And I just thought, gosh, I could take that character and bring him in here. And then when I figured out, oh, well, he could be Wyatt's boss, then it just clicked. And then it was really easy to get back into that character again. Now he's not a cop and doing those sort of things, but I can make him say all the grandiose type things he used to say about what a badass he is when we all know he's a little off or a little weird, but you can't help but love the guy. And it's just really kind of cool all these years later to still be playing that character and still kind of making an homage to this very notable teacher from my high school days.
We all have that teacher, and I immediately go to a shop teacher that I had. I go to my orchestra conductor that I had, Mr. Hoppy. You know, we all have Mr. Bill. We all have him. So I think one of the things that does it for me in the show is, you know, like you say, you can use him to lighten the mood. You can also use it to, for me, it gives it, it gives me that comic book feel to it. Not the cheesy comic book feel, but you, you always have the character in there that you're like, well, I'm glad, you know, you feel comfortable, you know, when you open up the comic book and go, okay, yeah, that guy's in there. And it feels good having them there. And for me, Mr. Bill, in the Crimson Files, he's my guy that I, you know, if he's in an episode, I'm there with you 110%, you know, and
that's awesome.
Every time I play it at work, because I usually leave my office door open, and folks, this is a safe for work podcast.
yes.
Some of the other podcasts that I listen to, which are not safe for work, Paris Review has a podcast that comes out, and I can only play that in my car while I'm waiting for the train, because I you know, literature and poetry get some language going on there, and it doesn't work too well with the federal government. They don't like that. But I'll be playing it. Mr. Bill will pop up. I'll crack up, and my boss will come across, and she'll try her best to do Mr. Bill, but she just can't.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He does like, have. I mean, that's so crazy. He's got that very distinct voice, and I'm telling you. The way Mr. Bill sounds in the show is the way the real guy sounded. Mm-hmm. There's not even a little bit of variation. This is the way he sounded.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. That is exactly absolutely the way he sounded. That's what's so, I mean, and I used to do a lot more impersonation stuff in high school, but Mr. Bill was, or, you know, this teacher was definitely the most popular, and he just had that very distinct voice. That was the other thing that helped is, you know, if you don't know, I mean, you may not know, if you've heard me like just talk like this on a podcast, that's even me if you're not paying attention, because his voice is so different.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a distinctive, it gets right into your head, you know. One of these days I'm going to do a YouTube video where people can watch me, you know, point and do all this kind of stuff. But I mean, his voice just kind of drills right in your head, and you're just like, that's Mr. Bill. Ah,
yeah.
So
it makes it fun too sometimes when you have a voice like that. And this is, if we can get into seasons 3 and 4, this is something that you can play with. Mm-hmm. You know, cause it'd be nice to get Mr. Bill out of the office at some point in time. And it would just be really funny to have a scene where you're not expecting him to be there, and then suddenly that voice pops on. You're like, oh no, that would be fun, you know, because he's got that voice and you've got this outside of the office thing. You're not expecting him to be here. And then all of a sudden you hear that voice. It's like, oh no, what's he going to do? What's he going to say? What's going to happen? And that's the most fun stuff.
All right. I'm going to stop being self-indulgent. It's not about me. It's not about Mr. Bill. It kind of is. It is about Mr. Bill.
Yeah, anyhow, he would say it is, yes.
It absolutely. I should, you know what? Next episode, we'll have Mr. Bill on the podcast.
That would be cool. That'd be different.
I've never done that before.
You know, that's not a bad idea, really.
What are you doing next week? Hold on. All right. This question comes kind of from something earlier that you said, and I think I picked up a little bit with the Fanatorium podcast that was talking to you a while back. What pushes your creative drive when you have no audience or a small audience? You're starting a new project, and you're like, you know, is anyone hearing me out there? Is anyone reacting to it? You know, with a lot of the stuff that you're doing right now, you already have kind of a built-in audience. You're kind of a known quantity in your area there. But when you're first starting out there, what what pushed you to keep on going, keep on, making videos, making podcasts?
Well, that's a good question. And I think, I assume that you probably got a lot of really awesome creative people that listen. And I think they would, many of them would tell you what I'm about to say, which is when you've got that kind of just in your DNA, it's almost like I'm ADD too, and we're known for not being able to sit still. I'm the kind of, it's like when we go on vacation, my wife, you know, was perfectly okay with like going somewhere, kicking back and reading. Not me. I have to be going and doing something. From a creative standpoint, I can't be doing nothing. I mean, even if I'm going through daily life, doing the things I'm supposed to be doing, you know, working, doing things around the house, going where we need to go, whatever, the typical things, there's just a part of me that's always going to be screaming to create something. Mm-hmm. And I think that's it. I remember, you know, I love the show, The Goldbergs, and it's because Adam and I were very similar. Mm-hmm. You know, always filming things with my parents' camera. And I remember I would make these little movies and I would go in public and do crazy things in public for scenes in movies or just skits. And I remember my parents sometimes would go, "Why are you doing this? what's the point of doing this?" And even back then it was a much better question, because it's not like it was going to go to a YouTube and be seen, because there was no YouTube. But it was true then as well. It was, I got a camera, I can create stories, I got to be doing something. And then when I went to college, I was, you know, making a story that took place on college. And when I moved back to Dallas, I was like, okay, now I'm going to go out and find real actors. Cause back then I was casting friends. I'm like, I'm going to go and work with real actors and try to get better at this. Okay. And then, I didn't expect to make a TV series, but the TV series actually came off the movie that was made, because people responded to this one key component of the movie. And I'm like, all right, well, that needs to be a series. And once I did the audio production for the NPR affiliate here, I just, you know, I found myself loving that again, but I can do it all digitally versus having multiple tape recorders and a keyboard.
Oh yeah.
And I could apply a lot of the same things. And then when podcasting and audiobooks started to get a lot more immersive, then it was like, now I gotta do all that stuff I was doing back then, but put everything I've learned and take all these elements I have at my disposal and see what I really can do. And I think that's it. I think there's just a nonstop. There's something just has to be created. Exactly. You know, that really is the thing.
Well, there was obviously a void in the world, and we needed to have the Crimson Files.
That's right. Obviously. We had to have Mr. Bill.
in
more than one place.
Thank you for going there, because that's what I'm like. Yeah, we need to have Mr. Bill. Now, here's a tough question here for you, and it's tough for me too, because I don't know the answer for it. When do you know it's time to close a project or pause a project?
I think that's a really interesting question, because I think there's all kinds of answers depending on who you are, obviously. I mean, I remember Jim Henson deciding at the height of the Muppet Show, all right, we're done. We're done. I'm ready to do something else. What else can we do? So I think that's very common. For me, it just kind of depends on what the project is. I mean, with the 80s cop show parody, we were just ahead of our time. Mm-hmm. We clearly had an audience for it. We clearly had people that loved it. But YouTube wasn't there yet. This was early 2000s, and people were beginning to start thinking about uploading and creating independent content for the internet, but it just wasn't there. If we were doing that now, I would love to see what would have happened. Mm-hmm. And then after doing that for 4 or 5 years, despite the fact that we all kept coming back and doing it over and over again, even with a very limited budget, sometimes next to no budget, we just kind of knew, okay, well, you know, this isn't going to get distribution. We don't know what more we can do with it. We got to move on to other things.
Yeah.
Assembly of Geeks was, wow. I mean, that podcast, I grew that audience like four or five times in a year. I was told we'd double it in a year because I would ask the experts, what's realistic as far as growth? And they said, well, where are you at now? I said, well, we're at about 100 downloads. We've only been going for a few months. He goes, well, you're probably double that in a year. Well, we like quadrupled it in a year. Nice. And it was just going up and up. And then my house got hit with a hailstorm that was epic. We're talking softball size hails going through the ceiling that forced us out of our house for like 4 months. Yeah. And then that plus my job changing, by the time I was able to go back to Assembly of Geeks, I didn't have the time that I had once before. And I wasn't able to put all the creativity and story in it that I felt the audience deserved. Mm-hmm. And I felt it was more important, even though I knew people would be sad to see it go. I knew it was more important to feel good about what I was providing the audience than just to drag it out and mail it in. You know, it's like when you're in high school and you're in a relationship and one person knows they're not really into it anymore, but they don't want to break up. So they drag it out and they know I shouldn't be dragging this out.
Oh yeah.
It's kind of like that. I could keep making episodes, but they weren't like the other ones. Mm-hmm. And, I didn't feel good about continuing it if I couldn't give the audience what I think they deserved. So, it just depends on the situation, but there's definitely been some good reasons for why things had to stop.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. I've had with my original podcast that I started way back in 2006, I had it on Blog Talk Radio. Mm-hmm. I did that for 65 episodes. And about 3 years ago, I met up. I'd moved to Fredericksburg here 5 years ago, but I met up with a guy that was doing a podcast class. And I knew that I was just, you know, beating a dead horse with the original podcast from 2006. And it was just slumping along. I was like, it gives me something to do. And I really wasn't serving the audience. And then I learned how to do podcasts correctly and learned, there's a format, there's a formula, there's a way to do it. There's the whole sound aspect of it. And I can be artsy fartsy with some of the stuff here, and that's okay. You know, it's accepted. And when I learned how to do that, it was easy for me to kind of go, okay, I'm going to shed the old skin of the old podcast. We're going to go with the new podcast, same name. Now we're shedding the name and actually going, okay, well, it's no longer this old podcast from 2006. It is, you know, the new Create Art Podcast, which is what I've been trying to do for the past, you know, 3 years to inspire people to create. But for me, my path was, you know, I realized, hey, listen, I got to shed the old stuff. I need to kick it up a notch for myself because if it's not fun, I got other things to do.
That's important too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got to be fun.
It does. Once it starts to feel like something, oh crap, I got to do this again, or it starts to feel like work, then that is a signal. That's happened before too. And I had a very similar path with my first podcast. I'd come straight out of working at public radio for 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And it's funny. It was my wife that suggested I get into this. We were on vacation and I was job searching. And she goes, well, what are you going to do now? You know, I know you're going to need a creative outlet. What are you going to do? And I said, I have no idea. And she said, why don't you try podcasting? And because the work at the radio station had been so involved in the audience and involved in all these different things, I had this vision that I was going to create a show that was going to have all this audience involvement and audience talk and feedback. And we were going to talk about all aspects of entertainment, which was too wide of a net. and I also didn't understand that you're not going to start getting feedback from audiences until you start growing to, you know, 500,000, 600,000, 800,000, you know, 800 to 1,000 downloads per show. And people are, reaching out to you. I didn't know that back then. So I learned very quickly, oh, that's not going to happen like it did in radio. And I called it the Critic Show because my idea was we were going to have these people on and listeners were going to call in and we were all going to talk about things we like in entertainment. But I knew I wanted to have celebrity interviews as well, but I thought they're not going to know me from Adam. So I might get one every 3 or 4 months. Well, next thing I know, I start booking them every single time. And then at the same time, I learned that it wasn't going to be this audience thing. And then once it became a celebrity interview show and I started to tweak things, it was a whole different program that I just like the same thing. I ended up having to change the name because it didn't fit anymore. But along with that, one of the pieces of advice I learned the hard way, and I learned it after I'd made the mistake, then gone to a podcast conference and heard someone said, well, you know, you should do this, was, and I like this advice because if it, it helps you avoid what you and I are talking about, which is I had to do the same thing. By my 7th episode, it sounded so different. I had to take the first 6 off. Mm-hmm. Just because I wasn't as proud of them as I had evolved by the 7th show, which kind of sucked because there were good interviews there, but there was the rest of the program I had a problem with. Yep. And people will say, some experts will tell you that it's a good idea to sometimes produce your first, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 shows, but not air them.
Yep.
And then when you make that 7th, 8th, or 9th show, that's the first one you give to the public because for that reason alone, that it might sound, by the time you've listened to it and you tweak it and you do all these things, it might be a completely different show by then. And I ended up ending the whole thing in 2 years because like you, I wanted to say, okay, I just want to start from scratch, take everything that I learned the hard way and do a lot of things right from day one. Yep. And, but you know, the only way I was going to know that was by learning some stuff the hard way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I kind of, put it to getting a tattoo, you know, because I've got, you know, 15 of them and all that good stuff. And I make it a point to because I know it's going to be on my body for the rest of my life. I'm not going to get lasered off because, you know, what's the point? Because that costs way too much.
Yeah.
And I'll sit with a tattoo and, you know, look at it for if I can look at it for a year and still enjoy it. And go, okay, yeah, I want this on my body. Then I call up my tattoo artist, which is a former student of mine. And I've had her on the podcast now 3 times talking about photography, tattooing, and just general conversations about art. I'll call her up and be like, okay, slap it on my body. And she's like, it's been a year. I'm like, I know. But, you know, I know that, you know, you see all these people out here with, you know, tattoos that – misspellings, they regret it. It's, you know, their ex-girlfriend, their ex-wife, or some crazy stuff like that. Me, I've got no regrets like that. I take the time, and before I put it on my body, before I put it out in the world, you know,
that's a good analogy.
Sure, I want to be here. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I also think about those people who will put their team on their body and say world champions before there's a championship game. Because I'm like, oh, I know, man. I know they're going to get there, and then they don't even make the playoffs, and they're stuck with that tattoo.
Absolutely. And just for the record, I am not a Washington Nationals fan. I'm a Cubs fan, so I'm sorry that the Nationals beat the Astros in the World Series.
Hey, don't have to apologize to me. I'm a Texas Rangers fan. I'm in the Dallas area, so no worries.
There you go.
they're division rivals. We're fine.
Well, we beat them for you. Okay, so
that's right.
See, folks, you didn't know you're going to get baseball. You're going to get comic books.
Bit everything.
On our show, absolutely. Well, Scott, I'm going to end out tonight's interview here, and with our tagline here, and I'm going to ask it to you. Because our tagline here, our touchstone from day one has always been create more than you consume. And so, Scott, I'm going to ask you, how do you create more than you consume? Because you're a very creative guy, but how do you create more than you consume?
Well, I'm a lot more picky about what I consume, I think. I think the best thing I can say, and sometimes I'm not consuming something because I'm spending a lot of time creating something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, there's a time and a place for everything. Mm-hmm. And I think there's time for both. And, Sometimes, you know, you might be in a position where you, you're consuming something when you probably should be creating something. So, So I try to just make time for both. I mean, gosh, Crimson, I can't even tell you the countless hours of post-production just for a 25-minute show. It's hours and hours over days. And there are times where you want to go, oh, I just want to get up and watch TV for a minute. But you know, you got to get it finished. And, you know, then there's always the part of you that wants to, you know, it's on paper. Now you just want to hear how it sounds. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's as with anything, when it comes to creation of something, it's a time management thing. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that you definitely learn in podcasts. My first podcast used to be the 15th and the last day of the month. And I needed that time back then because that's how long it would take to edit and then try to find another person to come on the show and then book it through the publicist, wait for them to get back to you. And then when I started to learn from people like Cliff Ravenscraft and some of the big names out there where they're saying, look, you know, you got to be out there trying to do weekly if you can, or at least every other week, something where someone can easily fit into their podcast thing. That's going to be one of your keys to growth. And it terrified me to think could go weekly. But then, you know, and I have people ask, you know, how did you do it with everything you've got going on? How did you, you know, do that? And it is a time thing. It's one of those things where you just learn. It takes me this long to write it. It takes me this long to do the format. It takes me this long to record it. It's going to need this much time to produce it. And then if you have to tweak it in order to fit it in less time, you do it. So I think once you get those things down, that time management down, then you have your perfect time to consume and create.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know when I first started, when I was editing, when I learned how to do podcasting correctly after 65 episodes of not doing it correctly, I actually ran into Super Joe Pardo at DC Podfest 3 years ago. And I had just had a neck fusion, 3-level neck fusion. So my voice sounded like crap. But you know, I'm going with my buddy Kyle Bondo. Thankfully he drove me up there. I was on, you know, 5 different pain medications and, you know, he's running a class and I walk up to him and I'm, you know, in my horrible voice, I'm like, hey, listen, you know, I'm having issues. I'm doing a podcast. It's running about an hour long and I'm spending 8 hours to edit it. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you don't need to edit out every breath. You shouldn't be probably talking right now anyways, but you know, you don't have to edit out every breath. You know, you trust that your audience will be forgiving of some things because he's like, you're not running a audiophile podcast. You're running an arts podcast. So they're going to forgive some things that you're, you know, obsessing over. They're not going to, you know, hear every little thing that you're going to hear. And they don't know what's coming next. You do. So, yeah. You know, don't edit that out necessarily. And since I did that, I've taken other classes, talked to other people, you know, I can knock out a podcast, hour long podcast in probably 3 to 4 hours. Sometimes I can get, you know, if it's goes really smoothly, I can knock it out in 2 hours, but that's because of, you know, the tricks that I've learned. I've learned what I can get away with and what I can't get away with and where I want to put my focus, which is putting out really good content, putting out really good art.
Yeah. I think that's really good advice. And this is coming from someone who will edit the heck out of a podcast. I mean, but I'm talking about, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I'm tightening things up, you know, I'm making sure that if, you know, because in the natural flow of conversation, sometimes people will throw a curveball and, you know, suddenly get off track for a little bit. And sometimes that's entertaining and fun. And other times your audience is going, Hey, get back to what I want to hear. And that's a lot of the things that I'm editing for. But I think that point that the advice you got, from the advice you got was really significant because as a podcast consultant, I've told people that too. And I always use Amy Porterfield as my example. And as someone who, for my paid work, more of my paid work is doing content marketing. I know who Amy is because she's the world-renowned Facebook marketing expert. And a few years ago, she launched her first podcast. And she went in and was editing everything, the ums, the uhs, the breaths, everything. And her audience, she has the advantages of already having tons of people that love what she brings to the table and are going to listen. So they all told her, you're over editing. You know, they were telling her to, not so much that you got to leave all that in, but you don't have to take it all out because they want those conversations to sound like normal conversations. And the truth of the matter is when people are talking, well, they breathe.
Oh yeah.
You know, and they do say or on occasion. And people don't even notice it. You know, maybe if somebody stutters or stops and stops down or says maybe take a few of those out. But they told her to leave more of that stuff in so it sounded like a real human being having a real conversation and not something that's so over edited and so prim and proper that it's almost like it's been built by, you know, some sort of analytics thing. And that was one of the first pieces of advice she got. And I think it surprised her. And I think a lot of people should keep that in mind, because I think one of the things that people love about podcasts, especially that have discussions, are when things sound like conversations. And when they have an attachment to the host, that's one of the reasons why the attachment is there, is because they feel like they're hanging out with you. And they want to feel like they're hanging out with you. And if you're too busy trying to tighten everything up, you're not talking like you normally would. The audience is not stupid, and they know what you're that you've overdone some of that stuff. And they may appreciate it, but you also might hear from them too, going, hey, you know, we just want to hear you guys talk because we want to hang out with you.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Scott, you know, it's been fantastic talking with you here tonight.
You too.
I know we can find you at The Crimson Files. Make sure that you put the crimsonfiles.com. But where else can people find you out on the internet? If they wanted to stalk you, you know.
Yeah, well, there's several little places. I'll run through them real quick.
Sure.
Depending on if you're a podcast fan and you're into comic books, we do a show called Comic Book Noob, which is actually for people who are getting into comics for the first time. They're watching Iron Man and people like that on TV and film, and they're wondering, you know, how do I get into comics? Where do I start? I interview two comic book experts that will give you the basic information about one character in every episode and then tell you where to start reading. That's where you find, you know, Comic Book Noob is where you find podcasts. There's also comicbooknoob.com. We're about to take the Disney Plus Streamcast to the next level as shows. We're going to be doing show recaps on that. Same thing, Disney Plus Streamcast. You can find that. But I am at Mr. Scott Murray on Twitter. And my website is scottmurrayonline.com. And that's where content marketing and podcasting and all that stuff is all featured there. I use a lot of that for like consulting and content marketing work and stuff like that. So whatever interests people.
Perfect. Well, a wide variety of interests there for us all here. Folks, get on the Crimson Files. Okay. Yes. I'm an admitted fanboy. I'm going to go when you put out the t-shirt with Mr. Bill on it, I'm going to be the guy that buys the first one. Okay. I want the first
one.
Oh
man.
With his autograph on it too. I want the autograph.
I appreciate everything you've said about Crimson, and if some new people get a chance to listen to it, I'd love to hear what they think too. And I mean, it can be anything. I mean, even with everything that I've done, I still feel like there's things I have to learn. There's new things I can discover. I never think, nope, I've mastered it, and that's I don't have to learn anymore. I still think I'm learning. And a lot of that comes from things I hear from people. And sometimes that involves things that I'm going to tweak or change. Or sometimes it just when people say they love it, that just motivates you to do more. So exactly. I love to hear what people think, and I hope they enjoy it.
Perfect. Well, again, Folks, we want to say thank you to Scott for coming in and talking with us here today. We were talking about creativity. We were talking about a lot of the Crimson Files, even more of Mr. Bill. Definitely check out his shows. Check out all of his websites. Check out everything that he's doing. And we will see you on our next episode. Remember, Create Art Podcast. Create more than you consume. We will see you next time. This has been a production of Gagglepod Studios. To find out more about Gagglepod, please visit us at gagglepod.com, where you can find this and all the other podcasts in our network, gagglepod.com.